Maybe we can proceed to the next case as everybody gets ready. This would be Joseph Ryan versus Alberto Gonzalez. And Mr. Mwangi.
May it please the court, I'm Godfrey Mwangi for Joseph Ryan. We present today two issues, the first of which is whether the government met its burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Ryan was deportable. And the reason we raise that issue is because the regulation requires the immigration judge to inquire of the respondent, the non-citizen, whether he admits or denies the allegations in the notice to appear.
And the government says that you have not exhausted that issue, and with respect to the only issue that you really did present, this court's recent decision in Valera against Gonzalez pretty much closes the door. So maybe you could address those two points.
As to your first point, Judge Wood, the issue of the government's burden is so fundamental to the process that I don't believe either party can waive it, in the sense that the board's summary affirmance purports to have done a complete review of the record, citing to matter of Burbano, which is the board's precedent, saying that we agree with the immigration judge, but our agreement is only coincidental. We've done an entire review of the complete record.
But the point is, I mean, if you don't present to the board as a ground for reversal a particular point, you haven't exhausted the administrative remedies. And I'm not familiar with any case that says there's some exception to the exhaustion requirement for particularly fundamental points or anything else. It's a pretty firm exhaustion requirement.
Your Honor, the reason that I make that argument is because the government's burden is statutorily mandated by Congress.
Well, and so is the exhaustion requirement with respect to this court's authority anyway, right?
That is correct, Judge. And the board's superintending authority over the IJ is as an error-correcting tribunal. And in this case, the board more or less adopts the IJ's decision and takes it as its own. And so what the board is essentially doing is, notwithstanding what has been briefed to it, it is doing its own review. It's looking at the IJ's decision. It's determining that were we to be in the position of the IJ, we would have found the same.
Well, if the board had put a paragraph in its decision discussing the point that you're now raising, I doubt, speaking for myself, that I would have any problem with this court looking at it, because I would see that the board had given full consideration, all of the policies behind the exhaustion requirement would have been satisfied. But I don't see this point in the materials that were brought up to the board. I don't see anybody calling to the board's attention the point that you are now raising. And I think that's what you need to do in order to exhaust.
And again, Judge Wood, for what it's worth, I raise that issue because to me it is very fundamental to removal proceedings for the government to meet its burden. Otherwise, that threshold does not permit anything else to occur. Having said that, I didn't represent Mr. Ryan before the board.
I'm not accusing you personally of doing anything, but it's a problem from the point of view of our ability to review. Maybe you can discuss the Valera case, because I think I at least understand your position on the other point.
Well, my position is simply that the statutory counterpart doctrine, although the courts that have looked at it, the Third, the Fifth, and this court, have landed on the position that it arises around the 90s That doctrine actually, I think, goes as far back as the board's acquiescing to the Francis case from the Second Circuit. And the reason I say that is because Matter of Silva, which is the case in which the board adopts the Second Circuit's position on equal protection, has a concurrence by board member Irving Appleman, in which he reveals that as the board was deliberating over this, the INS presented a memorandum in which it indicated it was going to give relief to everybody and would not make the distinctions between exclusion and deportation. The Solicitor General was also not seeking certiorari to challenge the Second Circuit's decision, and board member Appleman speculates and says the equal protection position of the Second Circuit is probably to avoid a constitutional problem.
But, you know, it's one thing to say that you're not going to draw a distinction between exclusion and deportability, to use the old language. And it's another thing to say that the 212C type of relief is available no matter what the offense. And that was not the case prior to the AEDPA and AIRA amendments. And so our Valaire decision at least says, you know, if you could have gotten 212C before, then you still should be able to get 212C. But if you couldn't have gotten 212C before, then nothing expanded it in AEDPA and AIRA.
And the reason you couldn't have gotten it before is because this particular phrase, sexual abuse of a minor, is put in the statute by AIRA-AIRA. And if you're going to refer back to the time of conviction, if that is what you have to look at, because St. Cyr says put him in the position when they pleaded, there is no sexual abuse of a minor then.
Well, and that's where the government argues that, in a sense, we're talking about two different retroactivity issues. One of them is the availability of the 212C relief. The other is the fact that AEDPA and AIRA, or AIRA-AIRA, or whatever you want to call it, did expand the list of offenses that led to automatic removal, as we would now say. And that has been held to be retroactive.
But the way Blake, the BIA does it in Matter of Blake, the BIA explains and says the Congress intended a discrete type of offense that it targets in sexual abuse of a minor. Blake then says that offense as an aggravated felony is what cuts you off. However, in the Immigration Act of 1990, Congress amended the aggravated felony definition, but it didn't cut off 212C relief. What Congress did was, in expanding it, put a limit on how many years of imprisonment. And so if you argue, as they're arguing, that the preferred charge is an aggravated felony ground of removal, and that's what cuts you off, that is a distinction that's being made because of the new definition. And if you say aggravated felony cuts you off, that's inconsistent with what was being done after the Immigration Act of 1990.
You think the five-year limitation would then apply?
Well,
and this was less than 5 years?
Is that
what you're driving at? Or is it
no, Your Honor, because the five-year limitation wouldn't apply to him because at that time he had more than 20 years. And I'm not...
As far as the crime, the punishment for the crime.
I'm not driving at that, Judge Mannion, if I understand your question correctly. That's not what I'm driving at.
I thought you might be trying to do that. Okay.
No, that's not what I'm trying to do, Your Honor. What I'm trying to focus on is that there's a distinction between exclusion and deportation pre-IRA-IRA. Both occurred in immigration court. The standards for relief were different, and that's where the insistence of the Second Circuit that do not use arbitrary or fortuitous and irrelevant bases to split these classes of non-citizens who are essentially the same. The board went back and said, we can still eliminate a chunk of them by imposing this doctrine, which was really a product of the difference between exclusion proceedings in immigration court and deportation proceedings in immigration court. IRA-IRA does away with that distinction. And that, too, is the essence of our argument. Now, if you interchange inadmissibility with excludability, which I think is error, because inadmissibility applies to non-permanent residents, which excludability with respect to 212C did not, you're making a mistake, because 212C is not relief available to non-permanent residents. And so inadmissibility by itself is not the functional equivalent of excludability, because one goes to permanent residents, the other does not necessarily.
Okay, thanks. Suzanne Ferdino?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Richard Zanfordino for the respondent, Alberto Gonzalez. Briefly, Your Honor, we would actually address your point. We do believe that much of the arguments that have been raised to this Court presently were not exhausted before the Board. Indeed, regarding removability, we would point out to the Court at record at 60, the petitioner conceded removability. He submitted to the charges and conceded removability. The Board had no reason to discuss the issue or raise the issue about whether or not this crime was an aggravated felony.
Was this kind of odd? I don't know whether this is transcription or a strange way of phrasing it. You're looking at the part where he says, we submit the charges and concede.
He says we submit the charges. At least that's what the transcript says,
submit the charges.
The process of transcribing immigration hearings are done via tape.
It's so rudimentary, I know.
It can be a little difficult to get the word out, but we would still suggest that.
But the second part, nobody's just disputing that it says, and concede removability.
Precisely, Your Honor. Okay. We would also point out again that the aggravated felony definition, as this Court recognized in Flores-Leon, is retroactive. So trying to address the arguments raised by petitioner, the sum and thrust of one of them seems to be that because he's in removal proceedings, there's no longer this dual track. That's true. There is no longer any such thing as exclusion and deportability. There is also no such thing as 212C anymore because he's in removal proceedings. Now, even beyond that, he's simply not eligible for 212C, as this Court held under Valair. The Valair decision, in addition to the Third Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, and the First Circuit, this Court is in good company in the sense that circuit court after circuit court has held the viability of the comparable grounds test. And indeed, this Court itself recognized that years ago in Leal.
Although there is, I mean, at the end of the day, there's something troubling because at the time he is in the criminal proceedings in the state, the offense that he was convicted of was not regarded as an aggravated felony, the kind that resulted in the automatic deportation, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And
so he wouldn't have known then, you know, not having any better 20/20 hindsight than any of the rest of this, or foresight, or crystal ball, that the consequences were going to be as dire as they were.
That's correct, Your Honor. And Congress did, when they amended the aggravated felony definition, decided to make it retroactive. We point out that there's no ex post facto problem here in the sense that these are civil proceedings, not criminal proceedings.
I understand that.
One last point we've raised to the Court, which is discussion of whether or not this offense is an aggravated felony is a curious thing because petitioner has danced around and not discussed the actual text of the statute. One of the holdings of this Court is that the phrase sexual abuse of a minor that's in the INA is subject to the ordinary common sense meaning of that phrase. That's in Lara Ruiz at page 940. The specific subsection of which there is no dispute between the parties that he was convicted of provides that the accused, this is Illinois Statute Section 720, Section 5/12-13A3. The specific section reads, the accused commits criminal sexual assault if he or she commits an act of sexual penetration with a victim who was under 18 years of age when the act was committed and the accused is a family member. Now, subject to the ordinary common meaning of that phrase, whether or not it was raised to the board, even if we didn't have the exhaustion problem here, the board and the immigration judge properly found that petitioner was an aggravated felon. With that, we would submit that the Valera decision controls and that the other arguments raised by petitioner were not exhausted to the board and would submit on the brief unless there are any further questions from the court.
Okay. Thanks. Fired. So this case will be taken under advisement.